Hello and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, June 29th, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. Tuesday's weather in the Cedar Valley includes cloudy skies, a likely thunderstorm, and humid, humid air. Winds will be from the southwest at 6 to 12 miles per hour. Tuesday's high will be 83 degrees, with a low overnight around 64. On the front page of today's Courier is an article by Rod Boshart titled, Crops on Weather Roller Coaster. Iowa's notoriously fickle weather took crops on a roller coaster ride over the past week, state officials reported Monday. Crops benefited from much-needed rain, but more moisture is needed, especially in the northern two-thirds of the state, according to the latest crop report issued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture National Agriculture Statistics Service. There also were scattered reports of damaging hail and high winds throughout Iowa. Quote, an active weather pattern shifted into the Midwest last week, bringing several days of widespread and beneficial rainfalls, said Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig. Quote, the rain came just when moisture-stressed corn and soybeans needed it. Unfortunately, severe thunderstorms caused crop damage in parts of western and central Iowa, as well as flash flooding across southeastern Iowa, said Naig. The forecast shows additional chances of rain and milder temperatures are expected over the next week. End quote. Weekly precipitation totals ranged from slightly more than 1/4 inch in Sheldon to 8.1 inches in Cedar Rapids over the past week. The statewide weekly average precipitation was 2.13 inches, almost double the weekly normal of 1.09 inches. Monday's report followed last week's updated assessment by the U.S. Drought Monitor that much of Iowa continued to face moderate to severe drought conditions, but timely and beneficial rains have at least stabilized crop conditions. About 44% of the state reported severe drought, mostly in northern and central Iowa, with more than 90% of the state considered abnormally dry. Despite the volatile growing conditions, about 60% of Iowa's corn crop was rated in good to excellent condition in Monday's weekly crop progress and condition report. Also, soybean emergence was virtually complete, with 19% of soybeans blooming, 6 days ahead of the 5-year average. Some scattered reports had plants setting pods in 58% of the overall crop rated in good to excellent. While precipitation fell across Iowa the past week, amounts received varied widely. Northwest Iowa still reported over 2/3 of topsoil moisture short to very short. In contrast, districts in the southern 1/3 of Iowa rated 60% or more of subsoil moisture adequate to surplus. Even with the beneficial rains, topsoil moisture levels were rated 12% very short, with 82% short to adequate and 6% surplus, while half of Iowa was rated short or very short of subsoil moisture. State climatologist Justin Gleason said several waves of showers and thunderstorms brought measurable rainfall statewide along with multiple days of severe weather. Parts of southern and northeastern Iowa received heavy rain, which led to localized flash flooding, while portions of northwestern Iowa continued to miss out on higher totals. On a related development, Governor Kim Reynolds issued a disaster proclamation Monday for Linn, Monroe, and Wapello counties in response to severe weather beginning June 24th and continuing. The governor's proclamation allows state resources to be utilized to respond to and recover from the effects of this severe weather. This article is accompanied by a picture of Cadence Munier, aged 11, of Marion as she rests on the back of her cow Miracle in the dairy barn during the 2021 Linn County Fair in Central City on Friday. Cadence is part of the Prairie Union Wildcats 4-H. Another front page photograph on today's Courier is taken by Jeff Reinitz of the Courier, titled Deer on the Lam After Break-In. A deer crashed through the window of a Waterloo marketing company Monday morning. Passers-by called authorities after seeing the deer jump through the window at Village West Creative at 1730 West Ridgeway Avenue around 7:30 a.m. while the office was closed. When police arrived, they found the animal still inside the building. The deer eventually fled through the same window and darted across Ridgeway Avenue and disappeared. In another front page article, Jeff Reinitz writes, Charity head gets prison over theft of $494,000. A Waterloo charity for disabled residents that billed Medicaid performed exorcisms on clients, according to investigators. Kimberly Henney, aged 53, who operated Healing Harvest Ministries, which ran special needs services in Perspectives Behavioral Health, was sentenced to almost 6 years in federal prison today, Friday, for one count of wire fraud for stealing $494,000 from her husband's elderly aunt. Henney had said the missing money was used to keep Healing Harvest Ministries, a charitable and religious organization that provided services to Medicaid recipients, afloat when Medicare severed its ties with the operation. During sentencing Friday, an FBI agent testified about irregularities at Healing Harvest, including alleged so-called exorcisms performed on clients. The agent also told the court about the company's failures to pay wages and withhold taxes. In 2013, the government ordered Henney's company to repay almost $200,000 to Medicaid after the state of Iowa discovered Healing Harvest lacked accreditation, according to court records. In handing down the fraud sentence, Judge C.J. Williams noted Henney's fraud victim was, quote, highly vulnerable, end quote, perhaps one of the most vulnerable victims he had seen in a criminal case. Prosecutors allege Henney spent much of the money on herself, purchasing furniture, vacations, and paying her own rent. As part of her fraud scheme, Henney used a power of attorney to gain access to her victim's bank accounts and annuities without the knowledge of the victim's children who lived out of state. In 2015, knowing that the victim lacked the capacity to understand her actions due to severe cognitive and physical disabilities, Henney obtained a power of attorney over her victim's finances. Henney then transferred and spent the victim's funds for her own purposes, according to prosecutors. In November 2018, state authorities arrested Henney on related criminal charges. The next month, Henney entered into a stipulation in a proceeding the judge would later call a so-called sham divorce that awarded Henney $90,000 in retirement benefits. She transferred the $90,000 to other accounts she controlled, including a prepaid debit card, and then spent the funds. In addition, she pleaded guilty in federal court. Henney understated to the probation office certain COVID-19-related unemployment benefits she was receiving from the government. Henney was released on the bond previously set and is to surrender to the Bureau of Prisons on a date yet to be set. In other Cedar Valley news, Amy Rivers of the Courier writes, ammonia leak forces evacuation at Tyson. Hundreds of workers flee plant temporarily. Several hundred employees working in at least one department of Tyson Foods were temporarily evacuated Friday morning for what the company says was a, quote, minor, end quote, ammonia leak. In a statement, Tyson said it was investigating the leak. Managers evacuated a portion of the plant as a precaution Friday. Ammonia is used as a refrigerant. Quote, the safety of our team members is always our top priority, the company said in the statement. Normal operations resumed Friday afternoon. Employees on the so-called hit side of the plant were evacuated late Friday morning, according to a Tyson employee who didn't want to be identified because workers aren't allowed to speak to reporters. The employee said cut floor workers were instructed to remain at their workstations. Evacuated employees returned to work around 1 p.m., the employee said. The company said several hundred employees were evacuated. No injuries were reported. Waterloo Fire Rescue officials told the Courier they were not notified of a leak. Ammonia, a clear, colorless gas with a sharp, suffocating odor, is commonly used in manufacturing and refrigeration. It is a severe irritant, can cause nausea and vomiting, and may be fatal after prolonged periods of exposure, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In 2013, Tyson agreed to pay a nearly $4 million penalty and conduct third-party audits of its compliance with the Clean Air Act for accidentally releasing ammonia at plants in four states, including at Iowa plants, causing at least one death. In that consent decree, the U.S. Justice Department said the refrigeration system at the Waterloo plant, like other Tyson plants, contained more than 10,000 pounds of anhydrous ammonia. But ammonia leaks have continued to persist, most recently at a Tyson plant in Nome, Missouri, in February that prompted a hazmat response. Courier staff also report horror film premieres in Cedar Falls and Waterloo. Cedar Falls producer's movie will debut Thursday. Cedar Falls film producer Clint Bovers has announced two premiere showings of Sin, a new independent horror film shot on location in the state. The movie debuts at 7 p.m. Thursday at Marcus College Square Cinema in Cedar Falls and will screen at 3 p.m. July 17th at Marcus Crossroads Cinema in Waterloo. This Cedar Falls event features a pre-party with photo opportunities at Lark Brewing at 5 p.m. Quote, I'm really excited to see this one on the big screen, as I've been working on it very diligently through a small editing window. I think it will be a lot of fun, and I really hope everyone enjoys being back at the theater with us for this one, Bovers said in a news release. Sin is an engaging exploration of the big secrets small towns can hold, and imagines what can happen when those secrets come to light. The movie is a commentary on religion and ideology, family connections, and good and evil, seen through a local Iowa lens. Bovers graduated from Cedar Falls High School in 2018 and Iowa Central Community College in 2021. He is an up-and-coming Iowa cinematographer with 9 acting and producing credits. Buy tickets for $10 for the Cedar Falls showing at www.eventbrite.com. Tickets are available for the Waterloo showing also on Eventbrite. In police reports, Jeff Reinitz writes, Anamosa man arrested for taking $63,000 outside casino. An Anamosa man has been arrested after he allegedly hit the jackpot while rifling through a truck in a Waterloo casino parking lot over the weekend. Police were called to the Isle Casino Hotel around 9:15 a.m. Saturday for a suspicious person who had been rummaging through a vehicle. Officers caught up with Matthew John Peterson, age 25, of Cemetery Road, as he was walking away from the casino. They found he had a cigarette box containing meth and a meth pipe in his pocket. They also found he was carrying $62,900 in cash. Police determined the money had been taken from a briefcase that was in the bed of a Toyota Tacoma pickup truck with Minnesota plates that was parked in the lot. Peterson was arrested for first-degree theft and possession of meth. Bond was set at $15,000. In Metro briefs printed in Tuesday's Courier, Big Woods Lake has Story Walk. Visitors can now enjoy a story while on a walk out at Big Woods Lake. Story Walk pages will be mounted on mounted frames along the trail with activity prompts so families can read as they go. The path begins at the Big Woods Lake campgrounds and goes clockwise. Funding for this project was provided by the Cedar Falls Community Foundation, Robert and Shirley Berg Fund for use by the library. It was created by Ann Ferguson of Montpelier, Vermont, and developed in collaboration with the Vermont Bicycle and Pedestrian Coalition and the Kellogg Hubbard Library. WCA celebrates Latino culture. The Waterloo Center for the Arts, in partnership with community organizations and businesses, will host Fiesta, a celebration of Latino culture, a series of free, family-friendly events that celebrate Latino culture and diversity in the Cedar Valley. This year's festival is planned for July 8th through 10th at the River Loop Amphitheater. At 7:30 p.m. July 8th, the Waterloo Municipal Band will perform Quien Será as part of its concert set for the evening. The performance will also feature a Latin dance performance. On July 9th, there will be a musical drama titled Selena in Spanish with English subtitles as part of its Cinema on the Cedar outdoor summer film series. The evening will feature fun family activities starting at 6 p.m., including a piñata breaking at 7 p.m., a Zumba dance with Angelica Rodriguez at 7:45 p.m., and children's activities and cultural displays throughout the evening. The movie will begin at dusk, or approximately 9:15 p.m. El Camino Taco Truck will be serving food. On July 10th, the River Loop Rhythms will feature Tropicante in concert from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. The show will kick off with a full mariachi band set, followed by music in a variety of styles from throughout Latin America. The event will also include boxing and soccer demos and traditional Latin dance. Concessions, including El Camino Taco Truck, will be on site. And Caregiver Group Meets. Waverly Health Center will host a monthly Alzheimer's Dementia Caregiver Support Group from 12:30 to 1 p.m. July 6th. This event will be offered via conference call at 312-874-7636. Enter code 88704 when prompted. Jeff Reinitz reports, man sought in connection with May homicide. Police are asking for the public's help in locating a man in connection with a May homicide in Waterloo. Police investigating the May 15th shooting death of 23-year-old Dayton Lee Matlock Buss gathered information that 25-year-old Marcus Robert Sykes was in possession of a firearm around the time of the shooting. Investigators believe Sykes, who is wanted on a charge of felon in possession of a firearm, may be in the Des Moines area, and he may be with Sharika Monet Wilson, age 23. Wilson is wanted on an unrelated probation warrant for second-degree burglary and willful injury in Polk County. Sykes is described as a black male, 5 feet 9 inches tall, weighing 135 pounds, with multiple tattoos. Wilson is a black female, about 5 feet 1 inch tall and weighing 136 pounds, with the word Faith tattooed on her chest. Police were called to a report of gunfire in the 1400 block of Grant Avenue around 3:30 a.m. May 15th and found Matlock Buss dead at the scene. Also injured in the shooting were 39-year-old Bobby Lee of Waterloo and 30-year-old Shanela Hammer of Des Moines. Anyone with information is asked to call the Waterloo Police Department at 319-291-4340 or Cedar Valley Crime Stoppers at 855-300-TIPS. That's 8477. Tips may also be left at www.cvcrimestop.com. Tips may also be sent with Tip Submit or by texting the word CE-DAR plus the information to crimes. That's 274-637. In other local news, Jeff Reinitz reports 3 injured in morning crash in Cedar Falls. 3 people were injured when a truck struck a dog and rolled in rural Cedar Falls early Monday. According to the Blackhawk County Sheriff's Office, driver David Evans was heading west in the 8800 block of West 12th Street around 4:50 a.m. when the dog ran out in front of his vehicle. Evans and 2 passengers had minor injuries and were taken to Unity Point Allen Hospital in Waterloo for treatment. Cedar Falls Police and Mercy One First Responders assisted deputies. The Courier also reports 7 East High students graduate from Job Foundation program. 7 East High School students have graduated from the Job Foundation's Financial Education and Mentoring program. They include Latonio Davis Nestor, Kai Greer, Trinea Monroe, Tiffany Neiman, Marche Polk, Jassise Porter, and Deville DJ Rhombus. All of them enrolled in the program in elementary school and have participated in more than 120 financial lessons, saving a combined $32,000 during that time. The graduates earned money based on their program participation in school grades, attendance, and behavior. Throughout their involvement, approximately 60% of their program earnings were held in long-term savings accounts that now can be accessed. In addition to the financial lessons, the students obtained their driver's license, volunteered, applied for college, and donated to charity, all requirements of the program. For more information about the Job Foundation and program graduates, go online to thejobfoundation.org. The commentary page of today's Courier includes a column by Cal Thomas titled, Harris Lying with a Straight Face. All politicians tell lies, but the Biden-Harris administration is taking lies to a new level. They now want us to disbelieve what we can see. To paraphrase a quote attributed to the 19th century British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli, there are lies, damn lies, and then there is Vice President Kamala Harris. more than 90 days after being tasked to stem the record flow of migrants into the U.S., Harris finally went to the southern border, falsely claiming, quote, "We've made progress," end quote. She visited El Paso, Texas, while the real problem is in the Rio Grande Valley. Clearly, neither she nor her handlers wanted pictures of people wading, walking, and jumping fences to get into the U.S. with her there. Instead, Harris found a safe place where she talked with Border Control officers who have been overwhelmed with migrants in places where she was not. Predictably, she blamed the Trump administration for causing the problem, when in fact, Trump claimed to be on the way to a solution. Trump and a few House Republicans are scheduled to visit the border on Wednesday, leading some to wonder if Harris was trying to upstage him. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott said the real problems along the border are less in El Paso than in areas not protected by the unfinished border wall. Abbott said Harris would, quote, "fail in her mission if she refuses to speak to residents of the Del Rio sector, whose homes and ranches are being overrun by gangs and smugglers," end quote. Abbott has pledged a $250 million so-called down payment to resume construction of the wall. Governors in Iowa, Florida, Arizona, and Nebraska have agreed to dispatch law enforcement officers to Texas to support local officers and the Border Patrol. What frustrates and contributes to the anger many Americans feel toward their government is that solutions exist, but many politicians refuse to apply them. Recent TV interviews with migrants have shown they were motivated to come because they believed President Biden is making it easier for them to be admitted. Harris's recent speech, in which she said, quote, "Do not come, do not come," had about as much credibility as Bill Clinton's denial of sex with Monica Lewinsky. There are critics who say this is part of the plan by Democrats to, quote, "import," end quote, new voters and make the party a permanent majority. That may be part of it, but I suspect another reason is to undermine the values and traditions that built and have sustained this country from the beginning. There are those secular progressives who speak and behave as if they hate America and would be happy to see it brought down to the level of other countries or destroyed outright. What better way to do this than to dilute those values by traditions and traditions by importing foreigners? We see this dilution occurring at many levels, including language, culture, behavior, media, and academia. Anyone who objects is labeled with an unending stream of pejoratives. It is why many remain silent or flee in fear from the battlefield. Recent challenges to school board members at public meetings over what is being taught in some public schools gives hope that increasing numbers of Americans are fed up and are now pushing back. The ultimate pushbacker is Donald Trump. His visit to that part of the border where the largest number of migrants are coming across will help focus on the Biden administration's failure to deal with it and Harris's meaningless visit to El Paso, which is not, quote, "the new Ellis Island," end quote, as Representative Veronica Escobar, a Democrat from Texas, called it. Better to call it one of several, quote, "invasion crossings," end quote. Again, this is the opinion of Cal Thomas. Another column in today's Courier is written by Christine Adams, a professor of history at St. Mary's College in Maryland, a fellow at the American Council of Learned Societies, and a Spring 2021 Newberry Library Residential Fellow. This article, column, was written for the Baltimore Sun and is titled, "Why Do Conservatives Fear Teaching History?" Conservatives have long fulminated over so-called left-wing indoctrination in our schools, a charge that led former President Donald Trump to create a so-called pro-American curriculum, the 1776 Commission. Groups like Turning Point USA have long targeted professors who supposedly, quote, "promote an anti-American values." Groups like Turning Point USA have long targeted professors who supposedly, quote, "promote anti-American values and advance leftist propaganda in the classroom," end quote. Including, I presume, history professors like me. But what is it that I and my colleagues actually teach in the classroom? In my modern history, European history courses, students learn about the rise of Benito Mussolini, that in the wake of the March on Rome in October 1922, King Victor Emmanuel III asked Mussolini, leader of Italy's still small National Fascist Party, to form a new government. that he convinced the legislature to grant him power to rule by decree for a year to restore order and to end the socialist threat in the country. That, thanks to his control of fascist newspapers and his intimidating militia forces, the fascists, in coalition with other parties, gained a crushing majority in the elections of 1924. This majority was augmented by the Acerbo Law of 1923, which stated that the party with the largest share of the vote would automatically receive 2/3 of the seats in the Chamber of Deputies. Thus, Mussolini came to power in a legalistic fashion, undergirded by the threat of violence. Once in power, Mussolini used his control of Italy's legislative bodies to legally bring an end to democracy. They learned that Adolf Hitler, after the failed Beer Hall Putsch in 1923, served little time in jail, thanks to a sympathetic judge. Then he bided his time, building up the structures of the Nazi Party. The despair of the Great Depression, coupled with violent clashes between the right and left in Germany, paved the way for the Nazi Party's rise. Hitler, like Mussolini, came to power legally when President Paul von Hindenburg invited him to assume the position of Chancellor in January 1933. Hindenburg's staff and family believed that they would be able to control Hitler while enjoying the support of his rabid base. Also like Mussolini, Hitler used the legal measures available to him, including Article 48, which allowed the German president to rule by decree in times of civil disorder, to put an end to democratic institutions once he came to power. As those on the political right bemoan how so-called left-wing professors brainwash their students with so-called socialistic ideas and pass laws to forbid the teaching of, quote, critical race theory, end quote, I wonder how far these struggles to control the study of history will go. I am bemused at the idea that we, quote, indoctrinate, end quote, our students. While there are undoubtedly exceptions, most of us present our students with the facts of history. We ask them to read primary source documents and historical analyses. We train them to interpret documents and events, and we encourage students to tease out these ideas in classroom discussions. Students are smart. If they sometimes develop new opinions as a result of their history classes, it is not because we push them in a particular direction. Students are perfectly capable of reading a bombastic, nationalistic speech by Mussolini and hearing the echoes in modern political discourse. Those students who are aware of efforts in Georgia and elsewhere to restrict voting and to allow state legislatures to overturn electoral results they don't like may very well connect those changes to the tightening grip of authoritarian parties in the 1920s and 1930s. And I have no doubt that when we study the Beer Hall Putsch the next time I teach my class on Hitler's Germany, students will want to talk about the January 6th Capitol riot and wonder about its long-term implications. They will raise questions about ongoing GOP efforts to whitewash that history and to reject the label of so-called insurrection. Radically conservative politicians want to limit the ability of teachers to talk about structural racism because it may lead to their sons and daughters to question the racism still embedded in the U.S. Will they also forbid teaching classes on the rise of 20th century fascism and totalitarianism because the facts make them too uncomfortable? History does not repeat, but we can certainly learn from the past. It offers us keys to understanding our present and future. We need to call out politicians who try to control the history we teach to cloak their own lack of commitment to democratic institutions. They may want to ask themselves why they fear the conclusions that those who study the past may draw. Again, this is the opinion of Christine Adams, printed in today's Courier. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, June 29, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Rose Marie Johnson, born March 19, 1928, died June 27th. Rose Marie Johnson, age 93, of Waterloo, died Sunday, June 27th, at Lakeview Landing, of natural causes. She was born in Jessup, March 19, 1928, the daughter of John and Catherine Weidenreuter. She married Echo J. Johnson, known as Ike, April 20, 1948, in St. Joseph Catholic Church in Raymond. He He died September 12, 1995. Rose worked at Powers Manufacturing as a supervisor for 40 years. Rose's family would like to thank the staff of Friendship Village and The Landing for all the care she received while living there. Survivors include Evelyn Craig of Waterloo, Beverly Albright of Frederica, Jack Reuter of Gilbertville, and Kathy Ennen of Raymond, and many other nieces and nephews. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday, July 1st, at Queen of Peace Catholic Church, with burial in Mount Olivet Cemetery. Public visitation will be Wednesday, June 30th, from 4 to 5 p.m. at Haggerty Wachoff Grarup Funeral Service on South Street, where there will be a 4 p.m. rosary. Visitation will continue for 1 hour before services at the church on Thursday. Memorials may be directed to the church or Friendship Village Auxiliary. Online condolences for the family of Rose Marie Johnson may be left at www.haggertywachoffgrarup.com. Cynthia L. Mayer lived September 28, 1950 through June 26, 2021. Cynthia L. Mayer, aged 70, of Cedar Falls, died Saturday, June 26th at the Martin Healthcare Center in Cedar Falls. She was born on September 28, 1950, in Waterloo, the daughter of Gail and Gladys Grimm Garrison. She graduated from Waterloo West High School with the class of 1969. She attended business college and most recently worked as a customer service representative for Principal Financial. Cindy enjoyed sports, most notably the Iowa Hawkeyes, Chicago Cubs, and Minnesota Vikings. She was also an avid Waterloo Blackhawks fan, attending matches no matter what the weather. She loved crafting, crocheting, and animals, especially cats. Cindy had an independent spirit, and her life was an amazing tribute to perseverance and grit. Survivors include a son, Tyler, and Monica Mayer of the Philippines, her mother, Gladys Garrison of Waterloo, a sister, Deborah Randall Lee of Cedar Falls, as well as numerous aunts, uncles, nephews, and cousins. Memorials may be directed to the family for a memorial fund to be established. A public memorial service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, June 30th, at Kimball Avenue United Methodist Church in Waterloo. Public visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the services at the church on Wednesday. Burial will be immediately following the services at Waterloo Cemetery. Online condolences can be left at www.lockfuneralhome.com. Carolyn K. Miller, known as Carrot, lived April 24, 1958 through June 27. Carolyn K. Miller, known as Carrot, aged 63 of Waterloo, passed away on Sunday, June 27 at Unity Point Hospice. She was born April 28, 1958, in Independence, the daughter of Joe and Marguerite DeWald Miller. She graduated from Starmont High School and then attended the University of Minnesota and Upper Iowa College. She worked in the newspaper business for many years, then founded and operated Precision Printing in 1998. She also bartended in the area for many years. Carolyn was so loved by all that knew her. She befriended everyone around her, and she was, quote, mom, end quote, and, quote, Aunt Carrot, end quote, to so many. She opened her home and her heart to everyone she met. She is survived by her children, Jason and Lacey Capuan of Roseville, Minnesota, and Amy and Craig Lau of Cedar Falls, 4 grandchildren, Brendan, Chloe, Eliana, and Everett, a brother, Lyle and Nancy Miller of Olwine, 3 sisters, Ellen and Lloyd Bergfield Gaffney of Hazleton, Patricia and Rick Decker of Maquoketa, and Kathy Steinecker of Tyler, Texas, and numerous nieces and nephews. Services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, July 2nd at Haggerty Wachoff Grarup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway. Public visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 1st, and also 1 hour prior to services on Friday at the funeral home. The family requests casual attire for the visitation and funeral. In lieu of flowers, Carolyn requests plants and memorials be directed to the family and the American Cancer Society in memory of her sister Jane. Online condolences may be left at www.haggertywaychoffgrarup.com. Brian K. Killian, aged 77, of Waverly, Iowa, passed away at home early Sunday morning on June 27. A full obituary is pending. Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Waverly is assisting the family. Paul Shipper, born December 20, 1933, died June 26. Paul Shipper of Parkersburg passed away Saturday, June 26, at his home, surrounded by family. He was born the son of Andrew and Lena Johnson Shipper on December 20, 1933. He served in the U.S. Army from 1953 through 1955 and was stationed in Germany. Paul was united in marriage to Irma Meester at the Reformed Church of Stout on December 11, 1956. Together, they made their home and farmed south of Parkersburg. He was a faithful member of the Hope Reformed Church in Parkersburg. Survivors left to cherish Paul's memory are his loving wife of 64 years, a daughter, Bonnie, and Rodney Wessels of Applington, a son, Brian, and Brenda Shipper of Parkersburg, 6 grandchildren, and 18 great-grandchildren, 1 brother, Lee and Dorothy Shipper, and sister-in-law, Lois Wees. He is preceded in death by his parents, 5 brothers, 5 sisters, and a brother-in-law. Funeral services will be 10 a.m. Saturday, July 3rd, at the Hope Reformed Church, with burial at Oak Hill Cemetery, both in Parkersburg. Visitation will be from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Friday at Redmond Funeral and Cremation Services in Parkersburg. Memorials may be directed to the family. Redmond Funeral and Cremation Services in Parkersburg is in charge of arrangements, and online condolences may be left at www.redmondfuneral.com. Glenn H. Jeffries lived September 19, 1926 through June 26, 2021. Glenn H. Jeffries, age 94, of Waterloo, passed away in the early morning hours of Saturday, June 26, at the Cedar Valley Hospice Home from congestive heart failure. Glenn was born on September 19, 1926, in Manchester, son of Howard and Bertha Grimm Jeffries. He graduated from Manchester High School with the class of 1944. He went on to serve in the U.S. Army until his honorable discharge. Glenn married the love of his life, Joan Kropp, on September 3, 1951, in Prairie du Chien. He was a salesman and had worked at Jones Wholesale and Monarch Foods, retiring in 1983. Glenn was an avid outdoorsman and enjoyed hunting and fishing. He loved going to the family cabin and spending time on the boat, water skiing, and sitting around the campfire. He liked his trips to the casino with his buddies, and he had a special place in his heart for animals. In his later years, he could always be found in his chair cheering on Aaron Rodgers and the rest of the Green Bay Packers. Glenn will be missed, but he will be remembered for his infectious laugh and kind soul. He was a special man, husband, father, and grandpa. Glenn is survived by his wife, Joan Jeffries of Waterloo, son, Kevin, and Catherine Jeffries of Galena, Illinois, 3 daughters, Glenda and Ed Denny of Berlin, Maryland, Colleen Washcat of Waterloo, and Monica and Arlen Hosek of Shell Rock, 9 grandchildren, 17 great-grandchildren. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be sent to Cedar Valley Hospice. Memorial services for Glenn Jeffries will be 11 a.m. on Friday, July 2nd, at Kern's Funeral Service, with visitation from 4 to 6 p.m. on Wednesday, June 30th, at Kern's. Interment will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visit www.kernsfuneralservice.com for details. Mary Ellen Tonkin, aged 80, of Waterloo, died Sunday, June 27th at home. A celebration of life will be 10:30 a.m. Friday, July 2nd at Cedar Valley Community Church with a private family burial in Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 1st, for an hour before services on Friday, all at the church. Haggerty, Wachoff, Grarup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway is in charge of arrangements. Condolences may be left at the website www.haggertywachoffgrarup.com. That concludes the obituaries in Tuesday's Courier. Turning to the sports page of today's Courier, the lead story is written by Craig Sesker, focuses on Preft softball, and is titled, Tigers' Streak Continues. They can beat you playing small ball, and they can beat you with the long ball. Junior Maddie McFarland and her Cedar Falls softball teammates certainly provided proof of that Monday night. The speedy McFarland delivered two bunt singles from the leadoff spot before crushing a home run to spark the Tigers to a 12-1 win over Waverly Shellrock. Red-hot Cedar Falls captured its 12th straight victory in improving to 19-14 with the win at Robinson Dresser Sports Complex. Quote, give credit to our players for continuing to find different ways to win games, Tigers coach Steve Chidester said. Quote, our girls came out strong early in the game and put some runs on the board. We got off to a fast start and it paid off for us, end quote. Visiting Waverly Shellrock fell to 12-16. McFarland supplied an early spark by bunting for a single to open the bottom of the first inning. That set the stage for a 3-run inning for Cedar Falls. Quote, Maddie obviously puts a lot of pressure on the defense with her speed, Chidester said. She understands the game. She can bunt and she can swing away. She can do a lot of things for us offensively, and her defense is excellent in center field. End quote. McFarland launched a towering home run to center field to start the bottom of the fifth. Teammate Maya Brinker followed by blasting a solo homer to left before Avery Canfield ended the game with her second RBI double of the night. Quote, I'm able to bunt and use my speed to help our team by getting on base, McFarland said, but if I need to swing away, I feel confident that I can do that as well. I was fortunate to be able to do both in this game, end quote. Junior pitcher Syra Rasmussen was superb in the circle for the Tigers on Monday. She retired her first six batters she faced and finished with 8 strikeouts and 5 innings. The only run she allowed was unearned. Quote, Syra pitched really well, Chidester said. She has come back strong from an injury and she did a great job for us. I was very impressed with her performance, end quote. Rasmussen struck out the side in the fourth. She allowed a leadoff single in the fifth, but came back to retire the next 3 batters. She allowed just 3 hits. Quote, I'm definitely feeling a lot closer to 100% now, Rasmussen said. I knew I just had to throw strikes and that my defense would be there to back me up, end quote. Cedar Falls continues to roll despite losing 2 key starters, outfielder Gabby Townsend and shortstop Izzy Walker, to recent injuries during their winning streak. Quote, we've had some injuries, but our bench players and our JV players have really stepped up, McFarland said. They've really come through for us, end quote. The Tigers stumbled to a 10-game losing streak early in the season, dropping 11 of their first 12 games before going on their remarkable run of success. Quote, it's definitely super fun, Rasmussen said. Everybody on this team gets along great, and we're really playing well as a team. This turnaround is crazy. I honestly did not think we would be here, McFarland said with a laugh. But after that slow start, we had a better mindset. We kept working hard and we kept fighting, end quote. Cedar Falls has now won 18 of its last 21 games after the brutal start to the season. Quote, I'm really happy with how we're playing, Chidester said. I know the girls want to finish this thing right. We've got some tough games coming up, but I know we will be ready, end quote. Tuesday's prep softball games include Cedar Rapids-Washington at Cedar Falls, a doubleheader starting at 5:30, Cedar Rapids-Kennedy at East, a doubleheader also at 5:30, Cedar Rapids-Jefferson at West, also a doubleheader, starting at 5:30. No prep baseball today, but on Wednesday, Columbus will play at Decorah, both junior varsity and varsity, at 5 p.m. West plays at Cedar Rapids-Kennedy, a doubleheader starting Wednesday at 5. East plays at Cedar Rapids-Jefferson, a doubleheader starting at 5. And Cedar Falls plays at Linmar, a doubleheader starting at 5 on Wednesday. In the Northwoods League, Courier staff report, Bucks celebration put on hold. The celebration will have to wait a day. Needing either a win or a loss by the La Crosse Loggers, the Waterloo Bucks got neither Monday in their first attempt to clinch the first half title of the Northwoods League Great Plains East Division. Bismarck socked 14 hits as it topped the Bucks 11-7 at Riverfront Stadium. Meanwhile, in lacrosse, the Loggers trailed Mankato 3-0 in the bottom of the fifth when the game was postponed because of weather. It was rescheduled to be finished tonight as part of a doubleheader. Waterloo, with a record of 18-9, leads lacrosse with a record of 12-6 by 6.5 games in the league standings. Bismarck jumped out to a 5-0 lead, scoring twice in the third and three times in the fifth. Then Waterloo exploded for 6 runs in the bottom of the fifth to take a short-lived 6-5 lead. The Larks responded with a 4-run sixth and tacked on 2 more in the seventh. Drew Beasley hit a double and home run to lead the Larks. Jackson Rosencrantz drove in 3, and Brant Schaffitzel was 4-for-4 with 2 runs scored and 2 RBIs. Mike Campagna drove in 2 for Waterloo on a 2-for-4 night. Jalen Smith, Garrett McGowan, Blaine Marchman, Sam Biller, and Chris Seng also drove in runs for the Bucks. Seng, Biller, Reuben Church, Max Jung-Goldberg, and Campagna all had 2 hits in the game. Waterloo and Bismarck play again tonight at Riverfront in a 6:35 p.m. first pitch. In the seventh in a series on this year's 8 over 80 winners, Holly Hudson of the Courier writes, "Waterloo teacher thinks positive." Longtime Waterloo educator experienced civil rights revolution. Anne Phillips grew up in the small town of Leland, Mississippi, the 6th of 8 children. She entered adulthood at a tumultuous time in our nation's history. Quote, "I graduated from high school in 1959 and from Mississippi Valley State College in 1968, Phillips said. Both of her parents were teachers, and she, along with 4 of her siblings, followed in their footsteps. Phillips secured a job teaching at Bryce High School in Leland at a time when racial tension was high. During her second year of teaching, 1969-70, quote, "We had to close out records in January 1970 and reopen both the black and white schools in the community totally integrated a few weeks later. We had some racial problems, but we addressed them internally," end quote. Phillips was aware of the historic nature of what was happening at her school, as were her colleagues. Quote, "We talked to each other," she said. "Communication was very important. We were able to handle the issues that came up," end quote. Phillips moved to Waterloo later that year. Quote, "I had friends here," she said. "I was trying to improve myself," end quote. She was assigned to Kingsley Elementary School and would spend the remainder of her teaching career there. Quote, "I was the only black teacher on the staff for 28 years," Phillips said. "There were other black workers in the building and an assistant principal, but I was the only teacher, and that record still stands. It could have been strange for me, but I'm the kind of person, I don't let myself go down to negative. I gave them respect, and they gave me respect. I never felt uncomfortable," end quote. Through it all, children remained a priority for Phillips. When given the opportunity to go into school administration, she chose to stay in the classroom. Quote, "I wanted to be with the kids," end quote. Throughout the mid-1970s, Phillips directed the Vacation Bible School at Antioch Baptist Church. She also helped develop an after-school tutoring program at Payne Memorial AME Church. She worked with a committee that raised funds for Taryn Moorhead, a local baby with spina bifida. Additionally, Phillips co-chaired a fundraiser for an annex to Payne Church, is a lifelong member of the NAACP, and is a member of the Waterloo Women's Civic Club, which organized to address community problems. Phillips also is on the board of the Jesse Cosby Center. Quote, "We deliver meals, hold exercise programs. We sew quilts and donate them to hospice or sick or shut-in people. We have Bible study," end quote. Still, her heart is with children. "I love children. In fact, when I was teaching, parents would bring them early for one-to-one tutoring to help them catch up. I would see the pride they had in their accomplishments. That is a really good feeling," she said. "When you are teaching, you are preparing a child for the world," end quote. Quote, "I always look at the positive and not the negative. We are too critical. We always look at the negative. Look for something good in a person. Children should set their goals high and always set new goals. We should be willing to talk to the children. They are the next generation. We have passed the gavel to them. Now they have to keep the gavel moving," end quote. Phillips is concerned about racial tension in the country and how it is impacting children. Quote, "We have to resolve our differences and make our differences our strengths," she said. "We need to find solutions. Police need to reach out to the community, play with the children, talk to them. We've got to find a way to erase some of the negative," end quote. Quote, I wish we could talk about our problems. Problems can't be solved if you don't talk about them. There has to be a better way than what we are doing now. Each generation is responsible for the next generation, and we are failing this generation, Phillips said. Quote, I see the neighborhood kids, and I talk to them. I ask them if they are doing what Mom and Dad tell them. I tell them to just do it. They might be president one day. Kids will look for grown-ups demonstrating positive vibes. End quote. The Living section of today's Courier focuses on stars, stripes, and statistics. From celebrations to spending, here's a closer look at how we celebrate the 4th of July. Celebration plans. How consumers plan to celebrate this year compared with last year. This year, 84% plan to celebrate the holiday compared with 76% last year. 61% this year plan a cookout, barbecue, or picnic compared with 56% last year. 33% plan fireworks or a community celebration compared with 24% last year. 16% indicate they won't celebrate compared with 24% last year. And with the 4th of July comes fireworks. Fireworks injuries include 10,000 emergency rooms that treated injuries due to fireworks in 2019. 12 non-occupational fireworks-related deaths in 2019, 900 injuries from use of sparklers in 2019, and 800 injuries from use of firecrackers in 2019. The history of the 4th of July? On July 4th, 1776, the Declaration of Independence was approved by the Second Continental Congress, leading 13 colonies to gain independence. Philadelphians marked the first anniversary of American independence with a spontaneous celebration. However, observing Independence Day only became commonplace after the War of 1812. In July 1776, there were 2.5 million people living in the new free nation. On July 4, 2021, the nation's population will be approximately 331 million. There were 56 signers on the Declaration of Independence. A few fun facts about some of the signers. John Hancock, a merchant by trade, was the first signer. Benjamin Franklin, who represented Pennsylvania, was the oldest of the signers at age 70. And Edward Rutledge of South Carolina was the youngest signer of the Declaration of Independence at age 26. Today's Amy Dickinson column is titled, Reluctant Stepmom Wonders If She Should Stay. Dear Amy, I need to know if my marriage is even worth the trouble. I've been married to Jack for almost 2 years. This is a second marriage for both of us. I have no children, and Jack has 2 children, a boy and a girl. When I first met him, his children were tyrants who demanded their way and made a scene when they didn't get what they wanted. Jack's own family wouldn't have anything to do with the kids when Jack had visitation every other weekend. I have since resolved this issue through tough love, boundaries, and discipline, and the children have come a long way. Now that they are better behaved, Jack thinks it's no big deal to have extra time with them at our house, hours away from their mother, without even discussing it with me. He says that they are better now, and so I should want them to spend this extra time with them. I am allowed to work from home, and I am the one expected to be at home with them, as Jack works excessive amounts of overtime at his own job. Am I wrong to oppose having this extra time with the children, which affects my job and free time? We have a great relationship when the children are not around, but when they are, or are about to be with us, all we do is argue about my lack of flexibility. Please help me, as I do not want to walk away from my marriage. Signed, Losing It in the South. Dear Losing It, you don't say how old these children are, but I agree with your husband that if they are doing better, you should be willing to spend more time with them. However, Jack should not be parking his children with a resentful stepmother during unannounced visits. I assume their own mother might not be particularly thrilled that her ex is bringing the children several hours to stay at your home when he isn't even there. If you want to reverse this dynamic, the next time he notifies you that the children are coming to stay, you should let him know that you'll be working from the office and he'll have to find childcare during his own work hours. Step-parenting is extremely challenging, and certainly for a person who hasn't had any previous experience raising children. It can take a long time for a family to come together, especially when you see the children on an irregular schedule and feel so resentful of their presence in your life. It all sounds as if you feel good about your influence on these children and the positive impact you believe you've had on their behavior. But ideally, the children's father would take the parenting lead and you would offer a warm, stable, accepting, and supportive home life for them when they are with you. The two of you don't seem particularly equipped to be in a family together, but you could improve your home life, your marriage, and your parenting skills by enlisting the expertise of a family counselor who specializes in blended families. If your marriage fails, unfortunately, the children will pay the price. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, June 29th, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.